past to the present and changes to the characteristics of network links. We have a shift from local I/O to network I/O. All our of our web applications we are today using are all network bound. They all need a network link, otherwise they are only functional. They only provide limited functionality or no functionality at all. But this is not only giving us a new challenge, but also new opportunities for power management, and that's what I'm showing you on the next slide. So that's a regular operation mode of a peer-to-peer network, for example, where we have a mobile device participating in a peer-to-peer environment, sending and receiving data from other network nodes, and all those network links will drain the power. So that's the problem we have to face and to fix. We have come up with a concept called the early bird concept. Let me spend a few words on it. The early bird concept is it's a smart connector between the mobile device and the network nodes, and it is able to supervise the mobile device in specific parts, and it's also able to take decisions on behalf of the mobile device. It's an early bird. It's early because it does early evaluation, then takes some early assumptions and does early decisions. You can imagine there's a request coming from a network node outside, and the early bird is simply receiving this request, and at that point it can do an evaluation of the request. It can assume whether it makes sense to pass the request to the mobile device or not, and then take a decision. And let me show you how this works in the previous environment. So we have the early bird as a supervisor for the mobile device, and we have still one link which is draining a lot of energy. That's the link between the early bird and the mobile device itself. And we have other links. Those are the ones which do not drain any power from our device because the early bird is part of the wired network and isn't battery powered. So in this case, if we can reach something like that where we can proxy the traffic and somehow to save energy, we are good. I have some data to show you for expected savings. If we take a usual netbook powered with an Atom processor, we can expect it to consume about 7.5 watts when it's idle. I'm expecting 1.5 watts more in power consumption if we are either receiving or transmitting data. That is not only required for the network link, but also you can imagine that whenever we have traffic coming from a network link, we also cannot stay in a deep sleep state. So the CPU needs to wake up and storage device needs to be running, so we have a problem because we need to power more devices of the device. Also, if we are receiving and sending data, I'm just assuming to consume about 10 watts. So if you look at the task we should perform, it's an easy one, just perform it on a mobile device, you will see some similar results. If we should participate in a peer-to-peer environment, downloading 100 megabytes of data at a link speed of about 100 kilobytes per second, we can expect to be finished after around 60 minutes. And I will now show you the difference between using the device with an early bird and without an early bird. So at the top, you see a red line which shows the power consumption over the time without the early bird. So if we kick off the task, we first download and upload data because we don't have an early bird which is helping us. After 60 minutes, we are done, and at that point, we are chopping down in power consumption because we only need to upload, not to download anymore. If we compare that to the blue graph, when we use the early bird, we only have to download in the beginning because every data we are downloading is being recognized by the early bird. The early bird can cache the data, and when another network node is requesting data from the mobile device, it simply doesn't get the request to us, but is answering instead of us. And that's why we only utilize download. After 60 minutes, we are done, and the early bird can go down to its idle state because we don't have to download and don't have to upload any data. So that's the expected savings. I've written down the numbers. It's 29 watt minutes, and it's around 12%. However, I'm advocating that this is not the only thing we could do with the early bird. We also have other plans, bigger plans, and that's why I'm here today. I'm advocating that we should really push out resource-intensive tasks from our mobile devices to, for example, idle computers in the near environment. So if we have some idle computers in this room, you can simply run an early bird instance on this computer and transfer that task to this computer, let it compute, and simply return the result afterwards to the mobile device. Also, another possibility would be the speculative execution of tasks, where we simply try out a couple of different execution paths on the early bird, and we recognize, okay, this one is the most efficient one, let's give this one as a scheduling information to the mobile device, and then the mobile device can use that information for the execution, which is either the quickest or is draining the least power. So let me summarize what I've been talking about. First of all, local power management is no longer enough. I'm advocating the use of network links for pushing out jobs to other devices, so we should utilize the resources in our distributed environment. This will help us to gain energy savings, and we can use either those savings for quick execution on the mobile device or longer battery life. Last but not least, I'm planning to extend this concept in order to get a possibility of remote execution on network nodes which are not battery bound. So when we look at today's prototype, here's one from OLPC, I'm really looking forward to where we are in 40 years from now. Thank you.
Fantastic, Timo. We have time for a short question or two. Yes?
Yes, of course.
And what if somebody sends that machine a virus, for example?
Sorry, before you answer the question, may I ask you just to do the swap? So, Stephen, could you please doing that?
The question was whether whether the device and the server itself need the software.
Yeah,
yeah, okay, of course. Yes.
What if somebody gives them a virus?
The whole thing will be something where you need a decent amount of work for the authentication and also protection. If we think of early birds being shared by a couple of people, then you also have to make sure that the privacy of the data is respected. Also, on the other hand, it gives you new possibilities, because if you build a trusted environment out of an early bird and a mobile device, it would even be possible to do cryptographic executions on the early bird device and don't have to pass it out to cloud environments where you cannot trust anyone. So there's a lot of work to get those bits right.
Any other question? Timo, thank you very much again.
Thank you.
Well done on your time. Matthias, don't take it personally. And I think that I mentioned at least three times that we will have a panel. So it doesn't matter if I mention the fourth time after Stephen finished. Stephen is a Kiwi, so we expect to have a fantastic localistic presentation now. Go ahead.
Talk about how Haskell, the Haskell programming language, approaches the problem of parallelization. First of all, what is the Haskell programming language? It's a general purpose programming language. It's a functional programming language, and it's not object oriented. It's pure, which I'm going to be talking a lot about. It's lazily evaluated, strongly statically typed with an advanced type system, a stable, mature, open source implementation and strong library support, and it's quite fast. So what's good about Haskell? Compared to mainstream languages, it's easier to ensure correctness, powerful abstraction capabilities. The code is very maintainable. Development time is shortened because it's very good. High assurance, it gives you a very good high quality assurance for your software. So, what are the challenges of parallelizing code? I've just listed them here. Hopefully you are familiar with all of these. Now, one of the main synchronization issues that people come across is race conditions. And the problem is that if your code is threaded and you have a mutable state and you lock that state with mutexes, then the code becomes deterministic. So you get unpredictable race conditions and all these kinds of problems. Now, Haskell programmers don't really like race conditions, so they eliminate them altogether. And this is how. It's done through a thing called Purity, which we were hearing about Share Nothing earlier today. So this is Share Nothing taken to its extreme, essentially. So Haskell absolutely enforces Purity. There are only, as far as I know, well, there are not very many pure languages, and I don't really want to list them, otherwise I might miss one out. But it's also known as referential transparency. The function is a function in the mathematical sense. So if you give it the same inputs, you always get the same output. And that means you have to have no internal state. And it also means that you can't pass a reference around that points to something that you modify. Everything has to be immutable. And so if you have no mutable state, then you can't possibly have a race condition. So Paul here is talking about the Mercury programming language, which is also pure. That's what you need to pay attention to out of this talk. All data dependencies are explicit when you have Purity. The compiler is aware of all the dependencies. It also means that there's no concept of sequence, so the compiler's free to rearrange the sequence however it likes. So here's an example of a sequence dependency. You want to make sure that these two operations are performed in the right order. Okay. So pure code has its own advantages. It's not a sacrifice at all. In fact, it's the exact opposite of a sacrifice. It makes the code simpler and cleaner, and this is a very good thing. So it does this because it's semantically simpler. And that's quite difficult to put into words, but that's a nice short description of it. And it means you don't have to play what if. You know, all these different... You don't have to work so hard to reason when you're coding. So anyway, this is basically what Haskell is all about and what Purity gives you by itself. Now, Haskell is also lazily evaluated. What that does is it separates the description of the computation from the sequence in which that computation is performed. And then you have a strategy to evaluate that. So parallelism then becomes your evaluation strategy. At least if you can use a parallel or a sequential evaluation strategy. Now, here's just an indication of how fast Haskell is. These are, according to the computer language benchmarks, these are the top 15 fastest languages, and Haskell is number 10. So, Purity is an excellent starting point for parallelism. It makes the whole problem a lot simpler. It eliminates a lot of the problems, all your race conditions and deadlocks, essentially. But it doesn't solve it by itself. Now, here's something that functional programmers get all snotty about, and that is that parallelism is not the same as concurrency. Concurrency is the familiar threading abstraction. It can be used as a method to achieve parallelism, but parallelism is just using multiple cores to taking advantage of multiple cores or processes. So there are three methods that Haskell has of parallelizing things. The last one is not complete at the moment, but the first two, I'll go through those. First one is concurrency, which is your familiar thread abstraction. It has a severe disadvantage that it's non-deterministic, and what I mean by that is if you give it the same inputs, you're not necessarily going to get the same output, because it depends on a lot depends on the sequence. And so this is where this is the great source of bugs. Now, a thread in Haskell, when it manipulates data, it's doing everything immutably, which means that you can't have race conditions, and so it doesn't. Haskell doesn't give you mutexes. Instead, it gives you a variation of different kinds of pipes. But Haskell is not strong in the area of distributed processing, in the same way that Erlang is. Now, this is the really good bit. This is the bit. This is what. This is the way you can parallelize your computations in Haskell. What you do is you get your code, and you just put little annotations on saying, I want to evaluate this bit in parallel. Now this is a clue, and the compiler has the ability to do whatever it likes with it. Now, these are just added on the ends of lines and so on, so it's very non-invasive, which means that it's very easy to just play about with it and see if you can achieve results. But the whole process is a manual process, so you have to do a lot of measuring and so on. But a key point is that it's deterministic, so it's absolutely safe. The worst thing you're going to do is make it run slower. So this is the Haskell way of how to structure a program. What you do is you get the I/O and you put it all around the outside, and you try to make the inner core of the program absolutely pure and mutable. And then you can parallelize this bit here, and it's a much easier problem. So I put this into practice. So I wanted to use a very real example, so I had an attempt and it was a total disaster. So what the conclusion essentially was that I thought there was going to be exploitable parallelism in it somewhere, but I after a lot of work I realized that actually it wasn't there. So I had another attempt. It was a simpler problem, but it's also a real world problem. It's compressing polygons into a quad tree, which means that you have to split them up to fit them into the quad tree nodes, and it was much more obviously parallelizable. So this is what it looks like at the output of the program, and you can see they've been split up into various sized bits. So the first thing I did was I made it look like my diagram at the beginning. I cleaned up the code so that it was all the I/O was factored out of the internal logic. I added some annotations. It took me a little while. I had to spend a bit of time measuring. I had to sort of gain the skills to do it, and I graphed the results. So this is the ThreadScope tool, and there are some places here where I've failed to achieve parallelism, and I looked into it, and I figured out the problem was I had some absolutely enormous polygons, and my polygon clipping algorithm was not able to run in parallel, so that it completely blocked when it got a really enormous polygon. So you can see I'm achieving parallelization in some places, but not in others. The orange bit is garbage collection, and here is it. I'm zooming in a bit here, and you can see in some parts it's doing a lot of garbage collection, and in other parts it's doing much more processing, which is the green. And this shows you the degree of parallelization you're achieving. So it was a real-world problem. It was garbage collection heavy, which is actually tends to be true more for functional languages because there are a lot of optimizations to reduce the amount of memory allocation, but quite often you use a lot of it so that the languages are optimized to work that way. I didn't really manage to parallelize the polygon clipping. And here are my results. Remember that I didn't really achieve full parallelization on it. But as you can see, they're not that brilliant. But I've split it here into mutator and garbage collector. Now the mutator is what you call the bit that does the processing, and the garbage collector is the memory management, obviously. So the garbage collector didn't perform very well at all. Didn't parallelize at all. It is a parallel garbage. garbage collector. You can see there's a cost when we actually go to parallel.
Yep.
Ah, yes, I didn't want to fight OpenOffice, so I just left it the same size it was. This is the number of CPU cores, and this is elapsed time to run the program. So that's, yeah. What's that? Yes, exactly. That's true. This is, I believe, I'm not absolutely certain, but I believe that this is caused by an issue with Stop the World, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. The garbage collector completely stops the execution of the program. So there's a cost to starting that up. And that, I think, is the problem here, but I'll get into that a bit more. Here are some reasons why an annotation might not work. Now, I'm a little short on time, so I'm going to skip through a few of these reasonably quickly. But measurement is absolutely essential in this process because it's a manual process. So here's what you need. You do need to understand Haskell's evaluation, lazy evaluation. There's a learning curve associated with it. You need to understand your program, and you need to get a bit of practice in doing this. Thread scope could do with a little bit of improvement. It's a bit hard to associate the execution of the program with the point in the program, which is fine for small programs, but I was doing this on a very large program. Now, the parallel garbage collector is still relatively new. They're developing all this stuff very quickly. There's been an enormous amount of progress in the last little while, but one of the problems with it that's been mentioned is that there's no thread local memory allocation as yet. So garbage collector has to stop everything, and that gives you a bit of lock contention, and I believe that is the reason for these problems when you get into the higher numbers of cores. So it's a manual process, but it gives you relatively it's got a bit of pain to it, but it's relatively relatively painless parallelism. You do have to work at it a little bit, but the important thing is that the risk of introducing bugs is zero. And here's an example of code with an annotation in red. So it's calculating a whole lot of things, and at the end it compresses everything. And so this parallelizes the compression of a number of these polygons. Now, this is the future work, Data Parallel Haskell. The idea is that you have nested data parallelism. It's like MapReduce, only here it is. So this is more or less the way MapReduce and other data parallel things work. And what Data Parallel Haskell promises is that the individual operations that you're doing in parallel can be parallel ones, which means that you get a tree structure instead of a flat structure. And how this works is that we get this tree structure, put it through a transformation, and it turns into a flat structure. Now, this is quite a complicated process, but it can be done because it has been done before. So I'll explain this in a second. It's here are some, just a general idea of what it's all about. Now, these are the steps that are described in how it's done. Now, the reason why it can be done is because there's been a research project that has achieved it, but it's never been put into a mainstream language, so that's what they're attempting to do here. And here are the names of the people who are doing it. Now, here's the conclusion of my talk. This implementation depends utterly on Haskell's purity. Now, not only is hardware becoming more parallel, but a point that people sometimes miss is software is becoming more complex. So maybe the industry can solve these problems without discarding mutable state, or maybe it will come to the same conclusion that functional programmers have. And here's some propaganda. Pure functional propaganda. First of all, mutable state leads to dependency. As you can see, each of these lines may or may not depend on the previous line. This is a pseudo C++ or something. And it's a very difficult problem to figure out whether that's true or not. The other thing is shared memory, of course. I only wrote kills there, so it would look good, doesn't it? So it greatly complicates the shared memory greatly complicates the parallelism problem as well. It adds a lot of contention. So can we really afford to keep using mutable state? That is the big question I will leave you with. And here is the future. And that's the end.
Thank you, Stephen. And Stephen gave... Yes, sorry. There are a few statements that you left open, and I believe that some were just want to polemic. Do you want to take the question of the gentleman, which is keen to...
Yes.
And in the meantime, could you please stop this, because we need to change this thing.
Yep.
Sorry.
It's essentially it's the same, but it depends on whether you're using functional languages or not.
Well, my voice was less.
Oh, okay. Well, the only real difference. I don't really have time to go into all that, but the difference now to what it was before is that the implementations have come a lot further. That's essentially it.
Any other question? I'm sorry, did someone, Timo, Matthias, take the adapter? We need a... No? Then give me a sec. It's just a second, sorry. Right, after the classic logistics stuff, which is on its way, our next speaker from Australia, Paul, from the University of Melbourne, and this is the last one after we will have a small interval, which means that maybe he's allowed to spend another few minutes, or not. Can you guess what I will say now? We will have a panel. So, and the idea of that is that pretty much all the presenters and all of you will just sit together. And I would be extremely interested to hear, not only from the speakers, but from you, what do you have done? If you have done anything around parallelism, what do you aim to do? Okay.
Hello.
All right.
Cool. I hate need to hit full screen. Oh, it keeps.
There are a lot of cables there, so full screen. Good luck. I don't know how.
How do you these newfangled devices?
I think that's
slideshow.
That's the one.
I need to hit this button down here.
A little bit more. Look at that.
Okay.
Then a little bit back.
Don't.
Now I control when it advances. All right, I'm going to stand behind here. I'm just going to stay here. All right. As Nicholas said, I'm Paul Bone. I'm working towards my PhD at the University of Melbourne. I'm sponsored by the Australian government and NICTA. So they enable me to do cool stuff with parallelism, which is a really awesome job. And I've been working in Mercury, which is even a lesser known language than Haskell. So we've got some information about Mercury, but essentially it's pure, like Haskell is, although we manage IO a bit differently. We don't have the whole monads thing, which some people prefer. Sorry, some people prefer not having monads because they're a difficult concept.
Sorry for the interruption, but can we leave the social stuff afterwards? Cool.
Thanks.
No, it's not for you, it's for someone that I can see. In other words, shut up. Please.
All right. So, but unlike Haskell, it's eagerly evaluated. So we don't have lazy evaluation, so you can't build up an infinite data structure, but we don't mind. So it means that you can more reasonably know how your program will be evaluated, so, and have a few fewer costs at runtime. But essentially, as Stephen said, the purity gives you more code reliability. You don't have to be concerned with what's going on in other threads or the order of computations, and this allows the compiler to reorder code better. So to avoid this, so I've got to start my timer. Okay. And we all know parallelism's tricky. That's why we're all here. So. But some of the more trickier things, again, as Stephen said, are managing synchronization. Now, we've solved this with purity, and Stephen's shown us that, so I'm not going to talk much about that. But what is also hard is deciding how to parallelize something. And Stephen testified, it's difficult to do that. It requires a fair amount of trial and error. So there are other complications, say, when your program changes, maybe, or it's fed some different data, how does it then run optimally in parallel? So I aim to address some of these. And it's my hypothesis that humans aren't very good at this and are never going to be great at it. Your average program is not going to be good. So I'd prefer the compiler to handle this, just the way that we use compilers to generate machine code. Nobody writes a machine code or assembly code now, unless they're weird. I believe it's a completely rational decision. So we do this by the way a programmer might do this, and we'd recommend them to do it, is to